And I went ahead and tried that, you know, because I needed to do something. And for me, that's how I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, was through that, place. You know, but I can tell you that for me, it really wasn't, I got to be honest, it really wasn't the desire to really get sober. What it was for me when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous was the attraction. Because what I saw was people that were having a good time. What I saw, that people were living life on life's terms. What I saw, that the people were getting through things in their lives, you know, that that a normal person like me, an alcoholic at the time, would drink over, you know. People were losing their families, they were losing their jobs, all these things were happening, and they were drinking, man. I couldn't understand that, you know. But what I did was, what the old timers told me, you know, I kept coming back, and I kept sitting around here listening to people. And then finally, you know, right before I hit my 6 months of sobriety, you know, I asked a guy to sponsor me. And that's when the program started to work, because then I conceded to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic and my life was unmanageable. See, what I found out was that without no recovery, without no steps, what I found out was that my innermost self was still hurting. But I found out that I had all this guilt and all this shame, you know, on the inside. And I didn't know how to get let go of that. That was one of the reasons that I drank. The big book talks about that we have, that drinking was but a symptom, you know. And that's what when the relief came was when I got into the steps. You know, at 6 months of sobriety, I picked up my 6 month chip, and that morning was my mother's funeral. You know, my mother passed away. But that evening I went to a meeting just like this, and I picked up my 6 month chip, and I was able to stay sober because of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous that walked me through the process. You see, what I learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, was that the people that are AA members, the ones that carry the message and do the 12 steps and 12 traditions to live AA way of life, those are the people that walked me through the process. Those are the people that told me the truth. Those are the people that told me that, you know what, Abraham, this is what Alcoholics Anonymous is and what Alcoholics Anonymous is not. You know, we come here to stay sober, and we do it a day at a time. You know, our big book talks about a daily reprieve, and that's what I found here in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I can tell you that when they gave me the big book, my sponsor gave it to me, a second one. I had got one at the treatment center, but the second one he gave me, I threw it across the room on the table. And the reason I did that was because I didn't know how to read when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And nobody judged me here. Nobody told me that I wasn't going to make the program. What they told me was that we'll teach you how to read. We'll show you how to read. That's just an excuse is what they told me. You know, and that's what I learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous, man. What I can tell you also, man, if you're new, you know, you're going to get what you put into it, man. My partner Albert says the best, you know. It doesn't matter how we get here. What happens is, you know, what matters is what we do when we're here. You know, for me, it was real simple, man. You know, I got into those steps. They talked about that four step. When I got to that four step, and they talked about that, that, you know, a lot of people weren't doing it and they were drinking. And for me, I didn't want that to happen to me. So I went ahead and did that four step to the best of my willingness at that time. And it worked, man. You know, it worked. I got to look at me, uncover, and discover, like the big book talks about, things about me, and I was able to look at myself. Able to look at, you know, the things that were wrong with Abraham, why Abraham drank and why Abraham behaved the way he did. You know, and why I had all this hate and all this shame and all this fear. You know, and it got me through the process. You know, and then in my fifth step, that was an easy step. I did that one over there at the VA's hospital in Fresno, you know, with my sponsor. For me, that was a good step because I was able to talk to another human being about, you know, that first step and get right and get honest, you know. And it set me free, man. And then we get to that sixth step, you know, that's the step that separates the men from the boys, you know. And I was always like a little boy, man, you know, when I got here, you know, I wouldn't play if I didn't get my way, you know. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've learned how to become a man in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I've learned how to grow up here and be accountable and be responsible. You know, I guess our speaker's here tonight, right? Yeah, it's good that he's here. You know, and now you're going to be able to hear somebody from Fresno out of town, and enjoy hearing people that come from out of town take their time and give back to Alcoholics Anonymous what's been freely given to them. Thank you.
All right, so with without further ado, we'd like to offer a Warren Valley Group welcome to Gilbert for President.
Okay, good evening. My name is Gilbert Free, and I'm an alcoholic. Funny thing happened to me on the way to an AA meeting, if I tell you. There was a huge pileup in Kingsburg, and I guess in that first step, when we say we're powerless over alcohol, there's other things we're powerless over, too, and sometimes that's traffic. I'm a firm believer in traditions, and I respect Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's very difficult for me to walk in here late, but everything happens for a reason, they say. Everything happens for a purpose, so thank you for still allowing me to come in here and speak and share my experience, strength, and hope with you. You know, I always start off my story telling that I came from a very good family. My mom and dad have been married for 60 years. I've been married to my wife, Kathy, for 30 years. We have three grown children. We have two granddaughters. Nobody in my family drinks but me. By the time I was 20 years old, I had 14 moving violations on my record. I totaled three vehicles. That didn't make me an alcoholic. Man, this is hard to freaking get focused now. You know, I'm an alcoholic. I have a disease of alcoholism because when I at some point during my drinking career, I lost the ability, when I started drinking, I lost the ability to control when I stopped. That alone made me convince me that I had a disease of alcoholism. You know, I guess I get right into my bottom was at when I was 43 years old, I had an electric business. I had a farming, 50 acres I leased from my parents, a vineyard, and I had an electric business that I was the only employee. I used to do some 480 volt stuff. And anyway, you know, I'd run both of them into the ground. I was out of money one day. I was out of alcohol. I was out of everything. And our little 11-year-old son come in the house one day, and he asked, I told him to shut the lights off for me. He walked over, shut a light off. There was a big vantage bank switch. I'm an electrician by trade, so I had this big bank of switches. There's like six or seven of them on this wall, and he hit the wrong switch and come back all proud, you know, and I come unglued. And I came, and I started hollering at him. I started screaming at him, and our son was just, he's 11, and he loves his dad, and he didn't know no better, and he's just froze in the middle of the living room, and I'm just this freaking raving idiot just screaming at him, and he's just paralyzed. Tears are starting to run down his face, and I can't quit hollering at him. Kathy comes in. She comes from the back room. She comes in, tells me, you ain't going to do this anymore. She tries to protect Adam. I come over to the coffee table, and I grab her, and I love my wife to death. She is my best friend. And I come across that coffee table, and I grabbed her, and I threw her up against the wall, and I had her pinned up against the wall, and I told her to get the F out of my face. And she looked at me, and she had red in her eyes, and she told me, you better put me down. And what that told me was that I wasn't going to intimidate her anymore. She was done. And, you know, I'd been through three outpatient programs up to that point. They were done. And, you know, they told me to leave. Our 16-year-old daughter come running out of her bedroom. She come in, she pulled me off and told me to let her mom down. And she pulled me off, and our daughter's about 4'2" and about 105 pounds, and she thinks she's King Kong. And, you know, and she got in my face. She told me, you know what, I hate you. I love you because you're my dad, but I hate what you've become. And she said, I think you ought to leave. And I told them, you know, this is my house, you guys leave. And so they did. and they were gone. And the best way I know how to describe after that, they were gone for 10 days. And the best way I know how to describe that, being in that house by myself, was the silence was deafening in that house. I didn't realize it until that point. I thought this would be great. I can do my drinking and do, you know, the other things that I do without them around. That'd be great. I still hit it out in my truck. I'd go out there and I'd do it and I'd come back in the house. And I still couldn't drink in the house because I didn't drink around my kids or my wife. And finally what I realized after a day or two, what I realized was that I was stuck with myself by myself. And that was a place I never wanted to be. That's a scary place to be. Looking at Kurt down here, I got to tell one story. Kurt says one of my drinking career stories, and he loves this one. I didn't tell it last time you heard me speak. Was my first ticket was at 17 years old. I got pulled over. I grew up in Carruthers, and it was a Christmas dance, and I had this real cool looking 77 Chevy step side. It was all dropped, and Lord, you remember how we used to do them. And, you know, it was real low and it was all real fancy and everything. Well, I got pulled over, 17 years old, and it was for, exhibition of speed, speeding, open container, exhibition of speed, speeding, and driving without a license, all on the same ticket. But this was in 1977, so, you know, they don't do nothing to you then. I passed what they gave you, the roadside sobriety test, and they threw me my keys, and told me, the sheriff, and told me I could go home, and, you know, and I didn't go home. I went to the dance and everything. Well, what happened was I got my driver's license taken from me then, so I had two choices. Either my dad could take me in my ticket, this cool-looking step ride to school, and all my buddies would stand out front the first 2 days, and because I got my license taken for 30 days. So, the alternative was to drive the tractor to school. So I drove the tractor to school for the next 28 days. And Kurt loves that story. It was a lot better having to laugh at than having my dad sit there and they ask, Daddy bring you to school today, Joey? So there, I told it for you, Kurt. But back to, I was stuck with myself, by myself, at that house. And they weren't coming home until I went somewhere. And this time I had to go to an inpatient program. The outpatient, she said, that ain't going to work. So my sister-in-law had a friend. She called up the new an outpatient program up in Angels Camp. They got me the number. It's like 160 miles up there. It took me a day and a half to get there. That 160 miles. Really, I got there like in 7 or 8 hours, but I drove up and it was like 5:30, and I figured it had like a long driveway up this hill to it, and I got there at 5:30, so I figured I got there late and they probably closed down for the day and nobody would be there. So I went into town and spent the night, and I come back at 9:30 the next morning and did the rest of my stuff and drank another fifth, and I figured I'd go out on a whim. So what happened in that 30 days in that inpatient program that never happened in one of those outpatient programs was I found out life can go on without Gilbert running it. I guess that was my surrender. And what I mean by, I mean the simple things. I got down to the simple things. I'm a fanatic about a yard. Everything's immaculate. My yard always has been, always will be. The yard, the lawn got mowed, the weeds got pulled, the bushes got trimmed, the dogs got fed, the kids went to school, Kathy went to school, the car got gas put in it, all the bills got paid, and Gilbert wasn't there to do it. I guess that's where I started with my gratefulness, is one of the things I've never, you know, I guess I should say my sobriety date is May 1st, 2003. And one of the things I've always remembered from that is that life is now a gift to me. The kids and my wife allow me in their life. I found out that they can get along just fine without me. They did. They learned how to exist. They got along a lot better without me than I got along without them. I just put that. I need them more than they need me is the way I got figured. I'm thankful and appreciative of that. I realize that. I don't run their life. I don't control their life anymore. I find my little part, my little piece that I can be involved in their life. and I try and participate the best I can with that. There's a clock. I got to. Okay. You know, I did want to spend a long time on my drunk love, so I'll get along with the recovery part. When I was in that inpatient program, my first exposure to alcohol, in the outpatient program, I went to, you know, you have to go to meetings, get that freaking card signed, and, you know, and I sat in the back and I disrupted meetings, and I didn't give a shit. I didn't care. I went there just to get the cord off my back. I had no intentions of quitting drinking. That's why people ask, you know, have you ever had another sobriety date? And I guess I could say that I did, but I was never serious about it. I always had this thing that I could drink socially, I guess, that I would be able to stop by 5 or 6, you know, and go home and have dinner with the kids and the wife and then go to sleep and get up and actually go to work and work all day, you know, before, and that never happened, so. So this time around, my first exposure was the guy that gave me the number. I'd never met him. I talked to him twice on the phone. The first Sunday that came around was visiting day. This was 160 miles up to Angels Camp, around in that area. And they allowed 4 hours from 1 to 4, they allowed for visiting. And this guy took time out of his day away from his wife and his kids to load Kathy and our 3 kids up and bring them up on that first Sunday. And I was all pumped, you know, and on the phone with her and until I found out Rick was bringing them. And then all of a sudden I got jealous. You know, it's one of the 7 deadly sins. And I was freaking jealous. Now I'm pissed. You know what? This guy's after my wife. He wants my wife, you know, and all that shit's going, you know, because I'm stuck in this freaking place, you know, and I'm not in control and I'm fearful and all that stuff's coming up. And this guy's after my wife, you know, so now I'm pissed. So, I'm already, you know, when they finally show up and I get all these other buddies I had there at the house, you know, now they're all behind me. Yeah, we'll get him going, you know, and they pull up and I come out the door, you know, and I'm walking down the hill and Kathy gets out of the back seat. She's sitting with the boys in the back seat and our 16-year-old daughter's in the front seat. And all of a sudden I stop and what a cute kid. And I think to myself, well, how the hell is he hitting on her when she's in the back seat and Laura's in the front seat? That'd be awful difficult, you know? And I looked at him and I hugged Kathy, kind of. Laura, I love our daughter to death. She's always had me right there, you know? And, that's the relationship I wanted to heal quickly. And I hugged her and then I went to that Rick and the first time I met him and I shook his hand. You know, because real men don't hug. And so I shook his hand and shook it hard, you know. And I told him, why did you do this? He goes, that's what we do for each other, Gilbert. He says, that's what we do in recovery, is we help each other. And I couldn't figure that one out. I spent the whole day, and for like the next day or two, I'm scratching my head thinking, what the hell? What's this guy doing this for? So, you know, then Kathy found, so I ended up spending my time, you know, in there, and then I got out. You know, and there's one thing else I learned in that inpatient program. There's one counselor. He said, when you get out of here, you're going to hear all these stories about, you know, 3%, 6% make it, 3% make it, 1 out of 25 are going to make it, blah, 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 whatever. He says, I'll tell you, he said, this is my philosophy. He said, the big book says in here, you know, did anybody, something about half measures or something, he said, my philosophy is this, is if you get out of here, you find a fellowship, you fit in, you get a big book, you get a sponsor. He said, sponsors, a guy that's worked the steps, that has sponsors worked the steps. He said, you get one of those, you start working the steps, you get involved in that group, you start giving back, you chair meetings, you start giving back. He said, the recovery rate for those people in Alcoholics Anonymous, 100%. So, you know, I call back that recovery center. That home every year, I call them back and I tell them I'm still in 100% club. You know, and I thank them for that, you know. I got blessed when I got out, because Rick then, you know, he was my big brother contact when I got out. And, he took me to in Clovis to Sierra Fellowship. Sierra Fellowship, the first meeting took me Saturday morning. They have a men's meeting. Anywhere from the smallest I've seen it in 10 years is probably 45 men to as much as 75, 80 men show up there consistently every Sunday, Saturday morning. We have breakfast before, you know, we talk during the week, we see each other. A lot of strong sponsors there, a lot of sponsorship, a lot of solution talk there. Not too much, you know, on the addiction part and our stories out there, you know, it's all in recovery, and I got really blessed with that. I wanted to share sometimes there's a stigma, you know, when new people, you know, I guess I forgot to welcome the newcomers. Like I said, I'm freaking all screwed up. Welcome to anybody that's new or fairly new. There's a lot of stigma that I've heard when I first come in. I've got to find just the right sponsor the first time around and a guy that likes me, you know, and understands me and all that. So, you know, he can understand how to work with me because I'm special and I might be a difficult, you know, and unique case and stuff. So, like I said, when I got here, been married 20 years, three teenage kids, had two businesses, a farming operation and electrical. I run them both into the ground, whatever. My first sponsor didn't have any kids, wasn't in a relationship, never, you know, been self-employed, didn't have anything. He was just starting in the business world and everything. But what he did is he was on step 9, and I wasn't on any step yet. And he had a sponsor that had a sponsor that had a sponsor that had a sponsor. And I could go to a meeting and all five of them could be in the same, that men's meeting. And he had worked steps up to step 9, and they worked the steps diligently, and he was willing to do that for me. It's kind of funny how I found him was, and he was the perfect sponsor for me. For my first 4 years, he was the perfect sponsor for me. Other things happened. He got a life. Things grew. He got married. He got kids. He moved out of Clovis. Other things happened. I don't fault Ty for nothing. I love Ty to death for everything he gave me in those first 4 years. He was the exact person for me because I know God sent him to me, and this was kind of the God thing. I was raised around, my dad was Catholic, my mom was Methodist, and I was kind of confused most of my life, you know. Them two are like completely different religions and stuff. And then Kathy and I had ended up going to a Baptist church and got pretty involved in that, and before I went back out and got real bad. But so I knew God. I'd given my life at one point in time and dedicated my life to God. But when I got, and I'd done some bad things to some good people in between this recovery and when I was in church, and I didn't figure that God would really want me, want to see me, or he was ready to punish me. So I kind of stayed away and used the fellowship as my higher power for the first couple of years and stuff. My first taste of when you seek him, he will show himself was, is I waited as long as I had like 3.5-4 months before, out of the recovery center, before I got a sponsor. I was, and one day I could feel myself, I'm getting to the point, I need a sponsor, but I'm reluctant to ask somebody, don't know who to ask, nobody's been pointed out to me. And so this was the first time I finally got on my knees that morning, went to a 6:30 morning meeting every morning. I got on my knees and I said, okay, God, I'm not too good in this. You know, you've probably shown somebody, point somebody out to me. I really haven't been paying much attention. So today, you know, I'm ready. If you have somebody, point them out to me, I'll ask. I need a sponsor. Go to a meeting. There's a guy in that morning meeting. Never seen him before, never seen him since. He's in there. He has like 18 years or something like that. And like I said, I have like 3.5-4 months. And we share, and everybody shares, and it was a little meeting, like 8 or 9 of us. Everybody got to share, and after the meeting, I go over and I'm talking to this guy. And as we're talking, he asks me, he goes, so I listened to your story, you talked a good story and stuff and everything, but he said, oh, nice quick, do you have a sponsor? And I told him, yeah. And he looked at me and he goes, do you or don't you? And I go, no, I don't. I'm sorry, I don't have a sponsor. He goes, you know what? You ought to ask that guy right there. And I went, holy crap. And he said, he goes, that guy, I've heard his story. He's a good one. Go ask him. So I take off running. Ty's walking out the door. I take off running. I run out in the parking lot. Ty, would you be my sponsor? You need to be my sponsor. And he turned around and goes, okay, that's, yeah. Why are you asking? I said, God told me to. And he goes, well, I guess I can't say no, huh? One of the things that filled me in Sierra Fellowship, probably after that, and he's ended up, is Al A. sitting down here, and his wife Andrea come with us today. Ty told me, you know, I wasn't fitting in, and these guys were kind of scary that had the time and stuff, you know, and all of a sudden Big Tough Gilbert ain't more, and there's chinks in his armor, and my fear's starting to come out. But I need somebody to talk to. And Ty says, you know what, I don't have time. He says, call Al. You know, and he gives me his number. And I said, Al don't know me. Al won't remember me. He don't know who I am. I'm not going to, he won't have any time to talk with me. And he goes, just give him a call. He says, just give him a try. So I'm still in Carruthers, you know, and we've moved to Clovis now, but I'm still in Carruthers. I'm back on my patio. And I'm, you know how it is when you got, like, 4 months, you know, and you're freaking pacing, you know, and you don't know what to do, and you know what you want to do, but you ain't going to do that no more, and you know, and nothing good's going through your head, and I'm back on the patio on a pace, and I call out, I'm talking to him, he answers, I say, hey, y'all, this is Gilbert, you know, you probably don't remember me, you know, but Ty told me to call you, you know, he told me to call you and just listen, I don't know what you got to say or anything. He goes, well, first thing, Gilbert, thank you for calling. He says, why don't you sit down? And I went, I am sitting down because now you're probably pacing back and forth. Sounds like you're pacing all over. How the hell do you know? And he just laughed and he said, sit down. He said, I'll tell you my story. He proceeded to tell me his story for the next 45 minutes. I listened to Al and he told me his story. And his story was my story. And he told me how he got out of what he was into. And all of the fears and you know, and this is a guy at the time, you know, the first time I heard him share, he talked about wearing all these chains and driving this big black Cadillac, and I love big black Cadillacs, you know? And so then when I went to the next meeting, you know, Al was there and he came up and gave me a hug and we shook hands and Al and I have been friends ever since. You know, that these little things kept coming that I was, they were indicators that I was in the right place at the right time doing the right thing. And I wasn't doing any of it. That's what Alcoholics this time around, Alcoholics Anonymous has shown me this time around. Some of the other things that I've, you know, the fourth step, this is my story. I got my self-esteem back. I didn't even know I didn't have it until I did the fourth step and I got it back. I couldn't believe it. It was just like the book said, when we got all done and I got done dumping everything in the fifth step and it says, now go pull your big book off of the shelf and go find a quiet place for a while and reflect back and make sure that there's no stone left unturned or anything. And I did that and during that I went, all of a sudden it dawned on me, like everybody said, for years I shaved and never looked at myself. When I talked to people, I didn't look up. I always looked down. I couldn't look people in the eye. And it wasn't that I was intimidated by anybody. It's I didn't like who I was. All of a sudden, I was okay with who I was. The ninth step. The ninth step got me right with the world. You know, the biggest one I thought I had to do was with Kathy. We're over in Morro Bay, you know, we're in a room, and I've been prepared, you know, and I'm sweating, and I didn't sleep the night before, and I prepared, you know, I'd like to do this, okay, whatever, you know, let's do it. I have like a year and a half by now, a little more. We get all done. She's okay. I said, can you sit here and listen? I need to do this, and I really want. And I mean, I poured this out, you know, and I was wrong, and I was wrong, and I was wrong, and you didn't deserve that. And I get all done, you know, and I said, you know, now, hon, it's for me to sit and let you, you know, any rebuttal or any comments you have, I'm supposed to just sit and listen. She goes, you done? And I go, yeah. She goes, just go shopping. You know, I was really wanting to get beat up for some stupid reason. You know, I mean, I still struggle. You know, maybe that's what it was when I walked in today. I struggle, you know, with I'm okay and I'm out here and you guys really want to listen. I struggle with that when I find defects, you know. She said, you're doing a living, man. That's good. Another one was our daughter. Our daughter, like I said, she's tough. And there's some things that went on that during my recovery that got to this point that in about 2 years, I did Laura. And like I said, you know, her and Al battle all the time verbally. She's got a mouth on her. And I took her to Starbucks and I had her, you know, and another thing Ty did for me, and I don't know, this looks like a very strong fellowship for this many people to be here, and it looks like there's a lot of time, you know, some guys with not a lot of time and a guy with a lot of time, and women, and oh yeah, one thing I wanted to always say when I'm in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, I've seen some women that wear recovery well. It looks good on you. And thank you for a strong woman. Women's fellowship is great. Strong women in Alcoholics Anonymous are intimidating to me. But anyway, I'm at Starbucks and then I'm doing Laura, you know, and another thing Ty did for me was he didn't have any kids. And when I wrote Laura's out was the first one and I had three of them to do. And I wrote Laura's out. He read what I wrote. He put that back in and goes, whew. He goes, you know what does say in there on that ninth step that if to do so would harm them or others, maybe we shouldn't do it? He goes, I'm wondering if this doesn't fall into that. And I go, nah, man, I need to do it. I need to do this. With Lord, she deserves this, you know. And he goes, I don't know how to do this. And so his sponsor, my grand sponsor, has kids, and he's closer in age and stuff. He says, would you mind having letting Mike do that, do your amends with your kids with you? And I said, no, that's fine. So Mike did it, you know. And Mike got down. One of Mike said was, you know, one of them you'll put down on there was that at one point in time, drugs and alcohol were more important to me than you were, and that was wrong. And I said, I don't know if I want to say that. And he goes, you're going to say it or we're not going to do it. You're not going to do it. You know, and he said, you want to do half measures? What point is not drinking good enough for you, or do you want real recovery? You know, so I did it. And I got all done with Laura, and I sat back, and I said, you know, honey, now it's your turn. Do you have anything to say? And we're sitting in Starbucks, there's a chair sitting next to her, and she just kicks back, puts her feet up on the chair, crosses her legs, she goes, nah, you pretty much covered it all, Dad. You got a good one, you know? You know, our son was another one, our youngest son, the one that you know, this is going to be a lifelong amends to Adam. You know, Adam now is 23, he's engaged, he's 5'11", he's 150 pounds of pure muscle, and he loves MMA, he loves kicking and hitting people. He loves choking people out, you know, and I still don't know if I've made it up to Adam. In 10 years, I still don't know if I've made it up to him. I just, that day, sometimes my head and this disease get a hold and it just starts running. And I just want to call Adam and, you know, and I just want to hug him again and I want to take that one thing I want to take away so bad. And I just need to live with it, you know, and he said things are cool. But when I did his, he was, I think he was 13, maybe close to 14. We did it out in the park in Clovis, sitting on a picnic bench and pretty much all the kids were the same and they were pretty, you know, I was pretty honest about it. And I couldn't look at him. I looked down and just read it the whole time because I was afraid because I didn't think I'd be able to get through it if I looked at him. And I got all done with Adam. I looked up at him and he's just, one more time, he's just sitting there in tears. And he's just looking at me. And I go, what's wrong, son? And he goes, why would you admit all of that? I said, we have to. That's what we do. We have to. I admit it or I live with it and I can't live with it. You know, I did it because you need to know it wasn't your fault. Everything I did to you was not your fault. That was me. That was my disease. And that was this anger that was in it. And I took it out on you and you didn't deserve it.
and I need to let you know that that's why I did it. I ask him every once in a while if I need to do it again. You know, I don't know if that's selfish. I struggle with that. He says we're good, so I believe him, we're good. Probably the best one that I did was a guy in Carruthers. I don't know if any of you have been to the Carruthers Fair. I was a huge part of the Carruthers Fair. My family always has been my whole life. There's 21 people on this volunteer board that put that fair on every year. That's why it's free to walk in and everything. And like I said, it's a volunteer board that you volunteer to get on, and they vote you on if there's room, if somebody gets off or whatever. And I got kicked off of that board. I was the manager for a while, and when I stopped going to church, started my drinking career again and other things, and I got pretty bad, and I deserved what they gave me. But they got together, and they had this little meeting without me there, and then when the meeting came, they voted me off. And I took offense to that. I was really hurt. And so this one guy sells insurance there. He's pretty prominent in the town, and I figured he was head of run most of this, getting me out of there. So I kind of had some choice words for him, and I kind of got in his face in that meeting and tried to intimidate him, and it worked. And you know, and I said some choice things, and I decided I deserved him. He deserved an amends for me, and that was one of the tough ones. To call somebody outside the family or outside of friends that I still hung around or made up with or whatever you want to say. I called him up one day and asked him, I said, hey, you know what, Mike, I haven't seen you in a long time. You know, I don't know if you probably heard from my parents. You said, I know you see mom and dad all the time still. They come around town, so you know, you probably heard I'm in recovery now. And part of that recovery is we go back on the ninth step and we make amends for wrongs we've done, and I owe you one. I said, can I come to your office sometime at your convenience and meet with you and do my amends? He thought. He's on the phone and he goes, yeah. He said, we could probably do that. And he said, let me look at my calendar, and we scheduled for 3 days later. So I drove out to Carruthers. I went in there in his office, and I had pretty good. I'm pretty proud of my amends. I think I was pretty thorough and honest with him. And I read through it. You know, we closed his door and we read through it. And I got all done, and I sat back and I said, you know, now time again for me to sit and listen, you know, for any comments you might have on our relationship that we had or whatever. And he did something I'd never realized anybody would do. He sat back in his desk and he goes, you know, Gilbert, he said, listening to you, it just dawned on me. He said, I don't think you understand. He says, we were never mad at you. We were just mad at what you had become. And I went, holy crap. Really? You don't hate me? He goes, no, we never did. He said, my wife wanted to take a freaking bat and hit you with. Why would somebody that had the drive and determination and all the ability that you had ruin yourself like you were ruined with drugs and alcohol? We could never understand it. We couldn't figure it out. And we didn't know how to stop it. That's what we were mad at. And I remember there's a guy in our fellowship that used to always say, I hate the disease of alcoholism, but I love the alcoholic. And all of a sudden, that made sense to me. I think my time's up. Thank you very much for coming.